Thank you, Luca. So first of all, I would like to thank, and to be precise, to express my gratitude to Luca and Céline for setting up this marvelous event and for allowing me to speak in such a magnificent theater. As a longtime musician, I'm used of theater, but not in my new employment as physicist. So I'm a bit moved today to speak here at PI, and especially in this marvelous hall. So yes, I'm gonna tell you a bit of notions about what is called the covariant phase space formalism, which will be, of course, very useful for the majority, I would say, of the talk presented here during this marvelous conference. Hence, I plan to give more a lecture than a review talk in order to ensure that everybody here, PhD students and specialists, have some background knowledge about that before starting the conference. Okay, so I will probably be boring for the specialist, but I hope that the less specialist among the audience will keep something home from my lecture. So that's the plan for the two next hours we will spend together. I will give some comments on the definition of what an asymptotic symmetry is and some motivations why it's still interesting to study this kind of symmetries, especially in the example of asymptotically flat gravity, where you may know or you will learn that for a long time we discovered that there is a very particular group called the BMS group, which is acting on the null conformal boundary of this kind of space-time in Einstein's gravity. Afterwards, I will be giving some techniques, some technical tools, collectively called the covariant phase space methods, to compute charges associated with this kind of symmetries. And afterwards, I will finish, I hope, by describing the charge algebra associated with these asymptotic symmetries. And you will see that even the concept of symmetries is very old in physics. You will surely be surprised by what I'm gonna say. We will face some particular notions of non-integrability, non-conservation, and stuff like that. So be prepared, okay? And so let's start. So as you may know, the specification of a physical theory goes with two aspects. First, you have to give the kinematics, which will give the set of allowed states, the solution space, the boundary conditions, which will allow you to solve the equation of motions, and afterwards the dynamics, which are these equation of motion, which will control the evolution of the states. And the description of the solutions you will get will be easier in the presence of what we call symmetries, because they identify things that are preserved on the flow of some vector, some time evolution, etc. And are, as you may know, by Noether's theorem, are associated with hopefully conserved charges. For instance, in Einstein's gravity, you have the equivalent principle, which tells you that the theory is in fact a local field theory with gauge invariances, nicknamed diffeomorphism. So you change the smooth changes of observers. And so it sacralized a bit the principle of general covariance, meaning that the equation of motion are tensorial, and you can act with any diffeomorphism you want, you will preserve the physics. Hence, the charges associated of the change of coordinate are meant to be zero, and these transformations are pure gauge. But what is interesting for us is today is if you put a boundary somewhere, you will set up, and I will explain it in an example, a preferred class of observers, and you will give the asymptotic behavior of the fields as seen by these observers. And some diffeos will acquire a charge. And that will be your asymptotic symmetries. And if I take the perspective to fix a gauge, which is called the gauge fixing approach, which will be my principal interest today. If I fix the gauge, hence here for gravity, it will be namely setting a coordinate system. And I set some boundary conditions around an interesting boundary. So boundary conditions, I will write it BC from now on. Hence, what I will call asymptotic symmetry will be the set of residual gauge transformation, or here in gravity D fields, which preserve the boundary conditions. Okay. So there are many interests in these asymptotic symmetries. For instance, you know that the killing vectors are very bizarre animals in general relativity, because we don't meet them not so often, because you have to be in some stationary space times, or with particular differential conditions on the fields, etc. But this kind of symmetries can exist even if this killing or field symmetries are absent. And so we have a robust concept of symmetries, which is a bit more general, and that will give you a lot of physical information, because they will basically link unequivalent physical configurations because they are charged. They will provide you some charges through the covariant phase space formalism I will explain you. And at the quantum level, they will give you an organization of the quantum Hilbert space in some regime. For instance, if you are large distances, if your boundary is at large distances, it will give you the organization of the Hilbert space in the infrared regime. And for those of us who are interested by holography, these asymptotic symmetries are also very important, because they give, in fact, the global symmetries which govern the dual theory. But the famous example of asymptotic symmetries, which is the oldest one, and which was the first occurrence of the concept, is the physical context where you will be interested in observing a gravitational system isolated, and you will observe it at astrophysical distances. So that's the concept of asymptotically flat spacetime. Okay, so you may know the Penrose diagram of Minkowski spacetime, which is that kind of twisted square. And you will be interested in not in the strong field zone here, which can be populated by, for instance, two orbiting black holes or something like that. But you will be interested in the region where observers are far from these sources of gravitation. And in this region, you will not experience too much curvature. Hence, you can imagine that you are mostly in Minkowski spacetime. So here you will have a strong curved geometry, etc. But far away from the sources of gravitation, you can imagine that you are in the flat spacetime. And for instance, you will be sitting here with your interferometer to observe gravitational waves. And it's a very powerful model. For instance, you will be interested by measuring some kind of energy. But to measure energy in a system, you will need a clock. In general relativity, there is no preferred notion of time, no preferred notion of clock. But here, since asymptotically you are in the flat spacetime, you have a preferred notion of inertial observer that will give you this clock. The time with respect to this clock will be written U, and for instance, you will measure the energy of the system at a fixed time U, and you will say, okay, it's my energy. So, you know that, for instance, if you have two black holes orbiting here, they will emit some kind of gravitational waves that will travel at the speed of light, so they will travel like this. to your conformal boundary. In this setup, it has been shown very early, I would say, in the story of asymptotic symmetries, that the mass will decrease with respect to the time. Hence, if you take an initial time and a final time, the total amount of energy that will be lost by the emission of gravitational waves will be given by an integral on the celestial sphere of this quantity. And I will explain all the notation later, but it just to give some motivation. Where NAB is called the Bondinus tensor, and it represents a kind of Maxwell field strength, but for gravitational waves. Sorry. This formula, which is called the Bondi mass loss formula, is one of the most important in general relativity. It was derived in 1962 by Bondi, Metzner, and also I think a bit earlier by Trautmann, but I have to check that. But the history has retained the name of Bondi, so here comes the Bondi mass loss formula. So it's the first of many what is called flux balance laws controlling the phenomenology of gravitational waves far away from the source. And the nice thing is that I will show you today that we can derive this equation from a symmetry principle. In fact, the mass will be associated with an asymptotic time translation, which will be part of the asymptotic symmetry group. Okay? Now, just to be a bit more precise, with this clock U, I can say that U in the usual Minkowski spacetime is simply the classical time of Minkowski spacetime minus the radius, and I can write the Minkowski light element like this. It's a very simple exercise that I will not do here, where Q not AB is the unit transfer metric, and XA will represent the angles on null front, which are denoted by R equals to constant. Okay, so when you emit a light wave or a gravitational wave somewhere, air will be increasing, and so the final surface of them, which I will call scribe plus, it's the geometrical locus of points where R, so the radius of these expanding null fronts, is going to infinity. And then that is called the future null infinity. In the Penrose diagram, this hypersurface is here. Hence, the notion I am describing is more properly asymptotically flat spacetimes at null infinity, which means that all the spacetime in the class of spacetimes I am considering share the same structure at null infinity than the one provided by the Minkowski spacetime itself. Hence, if I perform this limit on that metric, I will get something which is zero that will die plus a sphere. Hence, null infinity looks locally as a null cylinder, which null time direction, I would say, here, and which is precisely my clock, so I will call it tau. And on this cylinder, the orthogonal sections, which are two spheres, are the so-called celestial sphere, which I will call S2, parameterized by these angles. And those will give me a notion of angular measurement for my asymptotic observer. Now I can ask myself, okay, what are the symmetries of this setup? Since I'm far of the source of gravitation, I am in Minkowski spacetime, so I will expect to have somewhere the 10 Poincaré vectors. And in these coordinates, what you can show And it's also a simple exercise to solve the Killing equation in this coordinate. You will have something like that. So let me take something useful. Yes, you will have that. Ouais, on va faire comme ça. I knew it, I knew. Where the RA is a diffeomorphism on the two sphere obeying this this differential equation. And the D naught is obviously the covariant derivative associated with this boundary metric, which is, as I recall, the unit transfer metric. Yes? Sorry?
Second term, the naught is
on the. Oh, yes, it will happen. It will happen again. Thank you, Marius. Okay, and last but not least, this function on the sphere, so T is a smooth function on the sphere, and which will obey another type of differential equation, which is the following one. Hence, if you know how to solve these equations, this will have six solutions, which will form the proper orthochron Lorentz group. And R will represent the Lorentz transformations, the rotations and special Lorentz transformation. And this equation will have four solutions. We will describe your four space-time translations. Hence, you have Poincaré written perhaps in not usual way, but that's it. But now from the perspective, one more comment. So these equations comes in fact from the solutions of the Killing equation on the angular coordinates, but if you just pick the order R square of it. And this one comes from the next leading order. But if you are very, very far, you can say, okay, this equation, I don't care, and I will not retry it. And in fact, you can, because on a null surface, you know that the direction given here by the vector tau is null. Hence, if you consider this observer or this, where I perform simply an angular dependent translation here along tau, these are as good observer as the other. Because in that direction, you have the lengths are zero because of the null character of the boundary. And so you can say, okay, I will redraw that equation and allow all the smooth functions on the sphere. Hence, I will trade the Poincaré group, which is ISO 3-1, which I will call is SO 3-1 in semi-direct product with the four translations, for another group which will be SO3-1, but now in semi-direct product with an infinite dimensional Abelian ideal of super translations. Okay, so the semi-direct product is due to the fact that the translation is a vector, so it will transform in a certain way under Lorentz transformation. So it's not a direct product. And this will be called the Bondy van der Burg Metzner Sachs group. Okay. No, if I pull back this diffeomorphism of the boundary, it's a simple matter of algebra to compute the commutator of these vectors, and I will get so the BMSO algebra that I will write for you, because it will be interesting, it will be important, sorry, at the end of my talk. So I will explain the notation, just one moment. Okay, and this notation T12 represents the parameter of the vector obtained by computing the Lie bracket between one BMS vector labeled by one and one other BMS vector labeled by two, and I forgot the two here. Okay, so you see here the semi-direct action of the rotation and the special Lorentz transformation on the translation and also supertranslation parameter. Okay, so the goal of the remaining of the lecture will be to understand how to compute charges associated with that kind of diffeomorphism and give a meaning from first principle of that kind of flux balance law. So my purpose here, apart of entertaining you for 2 hours in this morning, will be to set the stage for many talks in this conference. For example, Laurent Fredel's talk on tomorrow, in which will be talked about the role in constraining the theory of quantum gravity, so the role of asymptotic symmetries in this constraint. Romain Ruzziconi will talk us about holographic description of this flux balance law in the context of asymptotic flat spacetimes. Mark Geller will discuss several extensions of this BMS group for all values of the cosmological constant. Glenn Barnish afterwards will discuss a dual effective theories for flat space holographic constraint by this BMS symmetry, and more properly the quadjoint action of them on the solution space. A bit more example. So Marios Petropoulos will discuss some aspect of charges and dual charge in asymptotic flat spacetime in the context of the fluid gravity duality, which is very close to what I'm going to talk about. And perhaps the closest talk of mine will be the last one by Simone Speziale, which will give a modern discussion on the formalism I will introduce in the following. So we will give comments on how to improve the covariant phase space formalism to take into account new properties discovered soon in the field. Okay, so that concludes the first part of my talk. Are there any questions so far? No? Okay. So, let's move on. Oh, putain. Ah. Ça, c'est sale, par contre. Okay, so now let's see how to compute charges for these guys. So, if I say charges, you answer? Noether theorem, very well. So, the first idea is to use the Noether theorem for the symmetry generated by general covariance. So assuming general covariance, which I rewrite on my fields like this, so phi I are my fields, as local characteristics depending also on the fields. So that's the action of a diffeomorphism. So if I assume general covariance, I will have that. That's the definition of Xi to be a symmetry of my Lagrangian theory of fields. But you know that a variation of the Lagrangian is something proportional to the equation of motion, plus a boundary term, which I will not discuss now. Hence, as a consequence, there exists well, let's say GM because I don't know. G or J? J, I think. So you will have a J, which verify this equation. And this is the first Noether theorem. But for a gauge symmetry, this equation can tell you a lot more, in fact. Because if I develop the right-hand side here, this is a local characteristic, so I can simply write it as a linear function of the diffeomorphism parameter, plus no one derivative on it, plus blah, blah, blah for higher order theories. And then I can perform some integration by part to get rid of this derivative. So it will give something like that. Plus a total derivative. Okay, hence this object has the following structure. So the gauge parameter itself multiplied by something depending on the equation of motion. Plus the exterior derivative of an n minus one form. Okay, so the result is that the exterior derivative of the Noether current is equal to another total exterior derivative of another current plus this guy. And if you perform on this equation an Euler-Lagrange derivative with respect to psi, which will kill the total derivative, you will conclude that n alpha delta L delta phi is equal to zero. These identities, so one for each gauge parameter, I call the Noether identities, and old off-shell. So the existence of these identities is the reason why we often say that a gauge theory is a field theory with non-trivial identities among these equations of motion. To exemplify that, in general relativity, if you compute this, recalling that this is simply the Lie derivative along psi of the metric, and performing several integration by parts, you can show that in n dimensions, you will have this relation. So just to give you a concrete example of this relation. Plus and this is an example of that equation. Here you have something that will be vanishing on the equation of motion, which is the case of x psi. And here you will have an identity which is meant to be to hold off shell, which is the Noether identity associated with diffeomorphism invariance, and which is called the Bianchi identity. So as a consequence of all that, I can write this equation. Which is the Noether second theorem for gauge invariances. And it involves this new Noether current, which is called the weakly vanishing current because it vanishes when the equation of motion holds. But now on shell, the corollary is that I have that equation, which I can integrate locally as so. And this is a catastrophe. because on Shell this will vanish, and this is a relic of the integration of this equation, so it's completely arbitrary. Hence, my Noether current is completely arbitrary or trivial. But this equation, in fact, can tell you a bit about the solution to that problem, because it suggests that the charges should be defined from a codimension 2 object rather than a codimension 2 object, or to be clear, n minus 1 form. Should be constructed from an n minus 2 form rather than an n minus 1 form. Hence, you will have surface charges instead of the usual volume charges. Okay, and you can say, is there a theorem which guarantees that these objects exist? And yes, this is the generalized Noether theorem proven by Barnish-Brandt and Eno in 95, which tell you that yes, for exact symmetries, like field symmetries in gauge theories, or more precisely, Killing symmetries in general relativity, these codimension 2 objects exist and define conserved charges. And now my goal will be to tell you how to construct this object for asymptotic symmetries, or to give a prescription to remove this ambiguity. And this is the goal of the covariant phase space formalism, which was initiated by Krenkovich and Witten in the late 80s. And afterwards, it was enriched by two complementary schools, the Wald schools and the Barnish schools, where you can find the most important article. I forgot the bracket. The most important article in both sagas, I would say. And in fact, the main idea is quite simple. Yes? Yeah. Sorry? I'm
just saying, way before Witten, it was, you know, there's been a lot of work in the Polish school. They're often not credited for that, but they're really inventing the entire formalism. You know, Gavitsky, Jabotinsky, so, yeah.
No, I perfectly agree. My historical perspective is a bit rude. Thank you, Laurent, for pointing that. And so the main idea will be simple. We will apply the techniques of Hamiltonian formulation of classical mechanics, but not for a solution space promoted as a phase space in the context of Lagrangian field theories without specifying a split between time and space. And the natural structure for doing that is what is called the jet bundle. The theory of the jet bundle is something a bit evolved, but I will try to summarize it in like 10 minutes, because I don't have much time. The jet bundle is simple, the idea that we need a phase space which will incorporate the fields and the space-time manifold. So let's pick up the space-time manifold, which is often called M, and we will fibrate it by fields over each point. Like this. So we have various points in the space-time, and here we have a fibration of the fields. The fields, the derivative of the fields, etc., that I will call collectively by this this multi-index notation. So in the base space, I have a local contingent. A contingent bundle, which will be spanned by simply the differential as it is habitual in the differential geometry. And I will have also a notion of horizontal, or in that direction, horizontal derivative, which will be defined as usual. So dx mu partial mu. Now for the fields. So I will be considering fields as abstract objects. Hence, I will consider here a field space, which I will call this ugly J. Field space. And I will say that my contingent space will be spanned by the variation of the field. and all the derivative also. Hence, I will need somehow a notion of vertical derivative. Which I will call delta. And this is simply defined by the sum of all the possible multi-index of this operator. The thing is that this partial derivative, let's say, has to be a bit modified in order to take into account of the presence of the fibers here. Hence, I will define it as so. So it's the traditional partial derivative plus with quotation mark extension, vertical extension, if you wish, to take into account the presence of the field. And so, is it clear for everyone the structure of the of these objects? Yes. Now a variation along a diffeomorphism will be considered as a vertical vector. So this is now a vector, and I will write the Lie derivative along this vector as this object. I don't want to say too much that it's a Lie derivative, because all the objects in the jet space will not be transforming as Lie derivative. But okay, let's say it for the sake of pedagogy. Since I have vectors, I will be interested in computing construction in this jet bundle. Hence, I will need the notion of interior product, which will be simply given by the following expression. All these formulas are pretty reminiscent to what happens in traditional differential geometry, by the way. So this operator is aimed at replacing a delta phi by a contracted delta phi. And now an object chi in this jet bundle will be called a PQ form. Yes, I forgot to tell notation. So the whole object for which a trivialization is M times J will be called F. It's just a notation. So it will be called the PQ form if it contains P. It contains P dx mu and Q delta phi. And I will give an example of that right now. Because now, let us get back to something a bit more physical. So the one proposition to compute charges is to start by a symplectic structure, also like in a traditional Hamiltonian formalism. But this symplectic structure will be deduced from the variational principle itself. Hence, let's compute delta L with respect to a variation of the fields, which I will define like that with the proper signs, etc. The minus sign here is due to the fact that, and that's important, but I'm not gonna prove it, that both vertical and horizontal derivative are Grassmann odd and anti-commute. You will see why this sign is important afterwards. So here you have the term which is proportional to the equation of motion, and here you have the relics of the partial integration needed to single out this equation of motion. Hence, Since you start from a form which is a top form in space-time, because you have to integrate it on all the coordinates, you will get here n minus 1, where n is the dimension of my space-time, one form on the jet bundle. One form because it contains at least, not at least, it contains a delta phi, and the exterior derivative of theta will be giving you a top form. And we'll say, okay, let's call it the presymplectic, the presymplectic potential. As you may expect, it will generalize the notion of the Poincaré one form, which is up to some choice, some choice of polarization in your phase space in classical mechanics, pi delta qi. And then you will be interested in computing the vertical derivative of theta, which will now be n minus 2, n minus 1, 2 form, on the field space, phi, delta phi, by definition. So that's a definition, and we will call that the presymplectic current. So omega, as I just said, is an n minus two, n minus one, sorry, two form on the jet bundle. So to know, it's just a matter of definition. Yes, please. The cube.
I guess I'm used to the D and delta commuting normally.
It's a matter of convention.
Is this a different D than the space-time exterior derivative that causes that, or is there something else with that? Going on.
Yes, I will say that because this is simply a consequence of this definition. You can prove it just by using this definition.
So it's not the space-time exterior derivative.
No. It's the so it will be the space-time exterior derivative if you neglect that part. But in the presence of the field, You need that part in order to write some equation like so, and give a formal definition of the object are we gonna use.
But that changes it from commuting to anti-commuting, because the space-time exterior derivative normally I would say commutes with delta, like in the Wald saga, I guess. I don't know.
Yes, but because in the Wald saga, they will not define omega, for instance, as delta theta. They will say, okay, omega delta 1 delta 2 is equal to delta 1 theta.
No, that's just notation. I mean, they are defining it as exterior. They're just writing out that definition in the Wald version.
Yes, but what I try to say is that if you contract this object with actual variation, you will recover two terms here as usual, and you will have the correct signature here. That's perhaps your problem.
Oh, okay.
Or not?
Possibly. Yeah, that might help. Okay, thanks.
But for now, they are abstract object on the jet bundle, and they are not contracted at all. Okay.
On this question, I mean, it's true that there's like two conventions, the bicovariant calculus and the one that we use in physics or Wald, if you want, convention, one where they commute, the other one where they anti-commute. But there's also a generalized homomorphism of complexness between these two things. So, mm-hmm. You know, depending if you're a mathematician or a physicist, you use one or the other convention. But
Yes.
In the literature, yeah, we don't use anymore the mm-hmm. bicovariant calculus.
Yeah.
Anti-commutative.
Exactly.
But there is a morphic.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So now that I have a current here, so an n minus one form on the spacetime, I cannot wait to integrate it on codimension one hypersurface, which I will call sigma. And that will give me something which is no longer a current, but a rightful form on the vertical space. And it will be my presymplectic form. So as a teasing for my second lecture, the charges will be obtained by contracting this object on the diffeomorphism. Okay, now let us talk about ambiguities, because all the formulas that I'm on the blackboard are ambiguous, in fact. Because you may know that you have first the freedom to add a total derivative to the Lagrangian, a boundary term, which will not affect your equation of motion. Hence, if you do the simple exercise to putting a delta here and not forgetting this property, you will have that your presymplectic potential will be modified by a delta exact term, which will not affect the presymplectic current, neither the presymplectic form nor the charges. A more subtle thing is that theta is defined by this equation. And it's ambiguous up to a total derivative. Which is called the Eierwald ambiguity, in fact. So you can say, okay, I have my theta and I shift it by the total derivative of an n minus 2 form, which will modify my presymplectic current by a boundary term, where this guy is simply delta y. And this ambiguity, in fact, which is called the Eierwald ambiguity, reflects our ignorance on how to select boundary terms in our presymplectic form. And okay, it could sound to naive eyes, I would say, as a bad feature of the formalism I'm presenting to you, but in fact, it's not. It's used, for instance, to renormalize the action principle or fix the value of the presymplectic potential in several cases, such as the holographic renormalization in the ADS-CFT, for instance. And if you are interested in fixing these ambiguities, there exists at least one prescription to fix them from the knowledge of the variational principle, which is kind of nice. A question? No? Okay. Sorry. So this is the Comper-Marolles prescription. So I know perhaps it's not the good name, but that's a name I'm used to, so I will call it like that. Imagine you have a boundary here. Let's call it B. And here you have the bulk, which is called the bulk, with the fields. And here you have the boundary with some kind of boundary structure used to define your boundary condition, such as a fixed metric on it, a foliation of the boundary, etc. And you will be interested in considering the total Lagrangian, which is the Lagrangian used to obtain the equation of motion of phi, so that's the bulk Lagrangian, plus a boundary piece, which I will call like so. And now if I take the delta of it, I will obtain, so delta LB, which is nothing but the equation of motion plus or minus the boundary term. And here I will do the same trick. So I will simply have delta LB with respect to the boundary structure. And this term is going to die because d square is equal to zero. And I'm left with this equation. Simply by merging the d terms. And I will say, okay, I don't want to modify my bulk equation of motion, but which is already automatic by this prescription. And I don't also want to impose the boundary equation of motion. And so I will say, okay, this is my final choice for theta dot. Hey. Certo. Okay. Okay. And it's a simple matter of algebra to show that theta dot I will choose will be simply the bulk presymplectic potential plus the variation of my boundary term minus the exact derivative of the presymplectic potential associated with that. And it fixes for you both of the ambiguities, the delta exact ambiguities and the higher one ambiguity. And in practice, this is what is done, for instance, in the Skenderis, Papadimitrov, De Haro, Solodukin, Skenderis paper of holographic normalization in the context of ADS gravity. And it was used also very successfully in a lot of papers, including mine, Laurent's paper, etc. Okay, so since I have just 5 minutes left, I will just discuss one property. I can erase that. I will just discuss one of the two main properties of this presymplectic current. And the first one is that omega is closed on shape, which is simple to see because you compute d omega. By definition, this is d delta theta. So I can invert them, but paying attention to the global sign. And I will have that. Afterwards, I can use this equation to obtain delta L plus the equation of motion. But this is going to die because delta square is zero. And I will have, which is zero on shell. Hence, if I now take two codimension one surface, hypersurfaces, sigma one and sigma two, and I compute here integral of omega on sigma 2, it will be integral of sigma 1, of omega on sigma 1, plus the value of omega on the boundary, here, because of, as an application of the Stokes theorem. Hence, it will allow me to distinguish between two cases of boundary conditions. The first one will be called the conservative boundary conditions, for which omega on the boundary is zero. Hence, my presymplectic current is conserved. This is something typical for time-like boundaries or for configuration of fields, which are decaying sufficiently fast when you go toward the curl B. And as a corollary, if you integrate this equation, you can see that on the boundary, the presymplectic potential is in fact exact. Hence, you can redefine your variational principle, your action S, as the bulk action plus a boundary term, which is this L, in order to have delta S prime, which is delta S plus the contribution of the boundary term. And this will bring the equation of motion plus a boundary term, which will be, in fact, the contribution of the presymplectic potential, but which will die because of this identification. So it will be zero unchained. Hence, as a consequence, you see that in presence of conservative boundary conditions, your action is stationary unchained. And I think I have to stop now, right? Okay, so I will resume in 10 minutes by talking about the other type of boundary conditions, which will be leaky, as you may imagine. So thank you.